those little historical things are very important for, I think, my generation of chemists. And I, to me, that's an argument for introducing more history of chemistry into science courses.
Why have they been important for you?
It was just interesting to see how they were Europeans, and it made me want to find out more about their relationships to each other or things like that. I'm just looking if I have the book on my shelves here, and we could see what they looked like. But they were really 2, 3, 4 line biographies.
Mm-hmm.
Very brief. Not biology, not physics, there was chemistry. And I was uninterested in engineering. Engineering, for my parents, would have counted as a profession.
What did they say about chemistry?
I think they sort of accepted it.
Was there I know with my own mother, when I told her that I was going to become a historian of science,
yes,
she had a hard time believing that people could actually pay you to do something,
yes,
like that. I'm wondering, even if people understood that science existed and that there were chemists, did they have knowledge about what it is chemist actually did you have knowledge?
No. Except what I had.
Right.
Yes, I did. I had a little bit from these people at National Bureau of Standards.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit from Brookhaven Laboratory. Both special settings, but these were clearly people with jobs. I was working with permanent staff members.
Mm-hmm.
I fell in love with professors. We all do. Professors are role models for us in many ways. I had no idea what an industrial chemist does. I had not been exposed even to the Primo Levi type description of what industrial chemistry is like. You get a little bit there. No one in the family was a chemist. The family were... There were no scientists in the family, but certainly there was a lot of respect for science and knowledge, which came with a kind of background that I described for you, of this middle-class European Jewish background. With that came a lot of respect for science. I don't think that first they had an idea that chemistry was a profession, even. But somehow they were reassured. I can tell you, for my part, I wasn't sure that I was going to be a chemist until halfway through my PhD. And I'll give you the evidence for that. I was in a straight line. I was going to go to graduate school. This was pre-hippie days, the idea of taking off a year or something. That was not part of my culture. It was not part of the culture of that time.
Where did you learn about going to graduate school as an option? Were there professors that were counseling you to go in that direction, or was this something you picked up on your own?
I picked up on my own.
Okay.
A lot of my friends went to graduate schools, to medical school, so I knew about that. Somehow. I was also exposed to graduate students. They were my TAs. One was especially important to me, Bob Schneider, subsequently was State University of New York. He was a graduate student. He was my TA in an introductory chemistry course and then in an organic course. And he was very supportive. Somehow, he was sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always mentioned him, and I remember him very well. There were graduate students around. I was at a university. In my senior year, I took a senior honor seminar. I mentioned good organic chemists. So two others were there at that time, two good organic chemists. There was one I didn't know, that was Chevis Walling. But the two who were younger ones were Breslau and Katz, both Woodward students. So this was my first sort of connection to Woodward. But somehow they didn't teach the introductory chemistry course that I had. That was taught by an older organic chemist, Charles Dawson, who is known mainly for some work he did on urushiol, the active chemical in poison ivy, principle. He's also known because he was the PhD advisor of Isaac Asimov, who must have been a special PhD student. Anyway, Breslau taught the senior honors seminar, and I have somewhere in his office little cards, sort of index cards, that I kept of papers I read for that senior honors seminar. And they were the first, they were Pauling, Mulliken, and a general aromaticity was in the air. That's when I first learned of Hickel's rule, was in a senior honors seminar. By that time, I had already applied to go to graduate school at Harvard.
Why Harvard?
I think I looked at places, and there was at Harvard at that time a good theoretical chemist who's, and I had seen some papers by him. I think I first read Coulson's Valence book, which also played an important part on influence on many theoretical chemists. And that person was Bill Moffat, William Moffat. The reason we don't know him so well is he died in my first year at Harvard, and I intended to work with him.
So at that time it was already sort of clear to you that you would like to go into theoretical chemistry?
Yes, it somehow was clear. The physical chemistry course, I had actually had a very important, interesting person in his last year of teaching, and he was not functioning well. This was Louis Hammett of Hammett Constance. Physical chemistry, but physical chemistry lab was a disaster. I won't even mention that.
I think that holds true for a lot of chemists.
And I've just mentioned introductory organic physical chemistry and physical chemistry lab. They were all not great courses, and some were terrible. It's a miracle I became a chemist, given those courses, and I think that's where Brookhaven and the National Bureau of Standards come in. And then in the last year, finally, some good courses.
Breslau.
And Introduction to Chemical Physics. That was wonderful. That's where I first see some of, you know, singlets, triplets. I see in that course at least the solutions to the hydrogen atom in quantum mechanics, the differential equation solved. I loved it.
What did attract you to that kind of thinking?
I don't know. I was good at it. I was good at the math. To me, it also, the math was vivified, was brought to life by the use in this chemical physics course. In the statistical mechanics one, it was the first time I saw a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. I saw the first calculation of the average speed of a molecule in a gas. And all of a sudden, all that calculus I had learned, which I didn't know what it was good for, I saw it used. I saw a differential equation solved. It was wonderful. It was clean. No one gave us an insoluble problem. Even the Hickel's theory was presented, and no idea how much calculations was involved, although it was said. Somehow I had mathematical skills, which I think were actually underused at that time. I knew I wasn't going to be a mathematician, and I was able to work at a very high level and learn things very quickly. So at that time I learned chemical physics. A little later, with Woodward, I learned organic chemistry. And with Lipscomb, or to whom will come, I learned other things. But why Harvard? I think because Moffitt was there, it was the top school. I didn't get into Yale, into graduate school. Applied there the second time. The third time was when I applied for a job. Didn't get the job after graduate school. But then they gave me an honorary degree, and those three previous rejections made a good opening to my honorary degree speech. Actually, they were very nice to me. Anyway, I began at Harvard, and I wasn't that sure about chemistry. I began in a program in chemical physics, which meant I didn't have to take so many chemistry courses. I don't know what.
Was this the program by E. Bright Wilson?
Yes, Bright Wilson was there very much. And then what happened was Moffitt, age 33, dies of a heart attack on a squash court, leaves behind a small family, and nobody else is doing theory. And so this is in December. I arrive in September. Moffitt dies, the person I'm going to work with. And so one of Moffitt's postdocs is Martin Guterman, who came from University of Chicago. He's made an instructor, and at the end of the year he's made an assistant professor. And on the day he's made an instructor, in February 59, middle of my first year there, he has four graduate students. It's pretty unusual that four graduates, because there were four people who wanted to do theory, there was nobody else. Martin Guterman turned out to be an excellent teacher. He was not promoted at Harvard, and he went on to University of Washington in Seattle and became an expert on something he was interested in from his graduate school days, that is porphyrin spectrum. The four people who went to work with him on that day, all in my class, were Bob Fulton, who then became a professor at Florida State, Georges Vanier, a Swiss physical chemist who was a professor at University of Zurich then, and Ron Felton, who was at Georgia Tech, all became academics. We began to work with him. I take lots of physics courses. I do okay in them. But I'm sitting in on other courses. I sit in on a course. I don't think this was that usual to do. I sit in on a course on science and public policy by someone in the law school. I don't know how I found. I think his name was Price.
Yeah, Don K. Price.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So I sit in on a course by Price. It was very interesting. It was about science policy.
Yeah, sure.
I take a course. I sit in on a course on stellar atmospheres with Carl Sagan, who's an assistant professor there. I'm responsible for not hiring Sagan here, but for inviting him to give his first seminar at Cornell when I came here eventually. Carl Sagan is an instructor in astronomy. I sit in on that. I decide to go in the summer to an archaeology dig. I didn't go. There is a Harvard-Cornell dig in Sardis in Turkey for long, many years. I applied to that, so does a girlfriend of mine from Colombia who eventually, I didn't go on a dig because she and I split up and we neither of us took that job. But then in my second year, I sit in on some other course I can't figure out. In my second year, I apply for an exchange to go to the Soviet Union. I'll tell you about that in a moment. I think, and I do go to the Soviet Union in my third year in graduate school. My mother thinks I'm going to get drafted in the Soviet Army because I was born in the Ukraine. This is only 11 years after we come to America, and I'm born in the Ukraine. But this is an official exchange. Her worries were misplaced that there wasn't. I go to the Soviet Union for a year. Harvard doesn't like it because you take a junior year abroad in college. You don't do this in the middle of graduate school in general in the United States. My advisor, Martin Guterman, I'm in the process of switching advisors from Guterman to Lipscomb. Actually, I did my PhD with both, but I started with Guterman. I think going to Russia, applying for that program, and then following through was all evidence that I wasn't sure about chemistry. I'm doing these other things. But when I come back from Russia after 3 years in 1961, I am sure about chemistry. I switch from Guterman to Lipscomb. I do my PhD work all in 1 year. I get my PhD in 62.
What ensured you then? Was it Russia? Was it a...
Can't figure it out. Because what I did in Russia, I'll tell you what I did, but it was in the physics department at Moscow University. It was something. I think I read Lipscomb stuff and I got interested in it. And Lipscomb was doing theory.
That was boron chemistry?
Yes,
boron. But in theory.
In theory. With Guterman, I'm already tooling up to for the extended Hickel method, even with Guterman. I tried to do a calculation with Guterman. Guterman was very interested in porphyrins. I learned something about porphyrins. I actually tried to make some porphyrins. I tried to do an experiment. And I have the first explosion in the new Conant laboratory with stuff scattered all over walls. Lucky I wasn't hurt. Happened at night. I decide I'm not an experimentalist. But I tried to do a calculation on cubane, C8H8, which someone at Harvard was trying to synthesize. And I tried to do an MO calculation, and I run into trouble. I set it up, and I think I'm thinking about it in Russia, and on the way back from Russia during a time in Sweden, I think, and where we stopped to see my wife's parents. 1960, I get married. After the first year of graduate school, I go to a summer school in theoretical chemistry taught by a great teacher, Per-Olof Lövdén. And that's where I meet my wife. It's in Sweden. At this point, I learn my eighth language. The ninth one is to come, the Russian, but I learned Swedish. On the way back from Russia, I'm jumping chronologically various places, I find a solution that I could program to the problem of setting up a calculation for something like cubane. So now there comes in another story which has to do with my professional development, that is the introduction of computers in chemistry and their use. My whole life is tied to computers from those days with Lipscomb till today, and my whole life is spent fighting computers and finding ways to extract out of those what used to be, I don't have them here, but they're in a student's office, reams of 11 by 14 accordion folded paper, but now as on a screen of this device. My whole life is devoted to subjugating those numbers and extracting from them verbal or graphic orbital explanations. So I love computers and I hate computers, and I move in the world between them. We'll get to that maybe tomorrow to talk about that, because I think that's important in what I've accomplished in chemistry. But the only introduction, I learned how to use computers in my first year at Lipscomb, 61, 62, the year I did everything on my thesis. I've got a lot of cooped up energy, because in Russia there wasn't an opportunity to do many things, but it was a very productive year. It's also the first year of our married life. It was a very important year for me, a number of ways. But I think for the beginning of my, the fact that I'm sitting in on these courses, the ones with Price and Sagan, and the one I can't remember, I'm exploring an archaeology dig. I'm applying for a program in Russia. That doesn't sound like I'm headed on a straight line for chemistry. Mm-hmm. And I think that's right. But somehow I settled down. And in Lipscomb, not so much in Gudermann, though Gudermann taught me a lot. Maybe in Gudermann already, in the porphyrin work that he let me work on cubane. I'm now becoming a professional theoretical chemist. And at the same time, I'm fortunate enough that the two people I'm working with, Gudermann and Lipscomb, after I come back from Russia, that they're both interested in chemistry, deeply interested in chemistry, in Gudermann in porphyrins, in Lipscomb in the boron hydrides.
When you say that, you mean interested in specific classes of compounds?
Of
right?
Some complexity,
yeah.
And not a diatomic molecule,
yeah, okay.
Which is so boring.
Yeah.
Lithium hydride, getting some excited state of lithium hydride, and getting the fourth significant figure in the dipole moment. These people were interested in real molecules. And that was the beginning. And Woodward kept it, the interaction with Woodward. I was very fortunate, because also they were introductions to inorganic chemistry with Lipscomb. And perhaps the biochemical side, which I never pursued. It's the only kind of molecules I haven't worked on with Gudermann. And then eventually when I developed the collaboration with Woodward, the world of organic chemistry. So I'm very fortunate that my theorists deal with molecules of some complexity. So I learned to appreciate the chemistry. Lipscomb especially was very good. So was Gudermann. Gudermann's interest was in spectroscopy of porphyrins. Why are porphyrins, and they said there is this very intense absorption line in the porphyrins. They're not just colored, they're very intensely colored.
So he used ultraviolet and infrared, or
yes,
what did he use?
That's
yeah.
What the ultraviolet.
Yeah.
In that. But he had a theoretical, he was a theorist, he had a theoretical explanation of that very intense line in the porphyrin spectrum. And it was a beautiful symmetry-based one. So now I get exposed in the summer school between my first and second year at Harvard. I get exposed to, in the summer school in Sweden, aside from meeting my wife, falling in love, traveling all over Europe, my first trip to Israel that summer, I had a very full 3.5 months away from Harvard. I buy a Eurail pass, I go all over Europe. I see for the first time the cathedrals in France that I had studied at Amiens, Rouen, and Chartres. That's the art history part from college. I had studied those.
This is 61?
The summer of 1960.
Okay.
Sorry, summer. No, I'm wrong. 59.
So before the trip to Russia.
Russia, go to 1960-61, this is the summer before. In that exposure in Sweden, I, for the first time, have a group theory course. A group theory is a very elegant part of linear algebra, and when applied to molecules, it's just beautiful. When you can write down the symmetry adapted orbitals for a benzene or for some C2V molecule, but all that, the language of this group theory, the irreducible representations, it was very attractive. Also, the quantum mechanics was at a much more advanced level with Levdin. He had other people teaching it. No chemistry to speak of there in that school, but the theory was very attractive. So why did I go to Russia? Because in the fall of 1959, in my second year, there comes to Harvard a very good physical chemist of Ukrainian background, Michael Kasha, Florida State. He gives a lecture course at Harvard and he talks about the work of two Soviet scientists. One was Taranin in Leningrad, who independently of Lewis came up with the idea of a triplet state for a molecule, and that it was important in photochemistry. And the other was Davidov, Alexander Sergeyevich Davidov, with whom I subsequently worked in Russia, who is responsible, a physicist, for exciton theory, energy transfer in a molecular crystal. So you have your one molecule that's excited, another one ground state, and the excitation switches to the second molecule and then propagates. That's called an exciton. And Kasha talks very positively of the work of these two Soviet scientists still active in this period. So the work, Davidov work is pretty recent. And somewhere I read about the Soviet exchange, the Soviet-American exchange. I don't know. This was one of those things where there was a summit meeting. I don't know if it was, this is the Khrushchev period. So this is Khrushchev and Eisenhower is still present. He must have been gone by then. There's some summit meeting. Nothing substantive gets agreed on. So you want to walk away with something that you can show to the press. You arrange an exchange of students. It means nothing.
It means nothing, but it's also a strange thing to have happen at that specific
period. From 1959 until this exchange died with the end of communism, there were 40 American graduate students in Russia every year and 40 Soviets in the US. The Soviets sent scientists and technologists. The Americans sent Slavicists and historians, which tells you something. And each side sent spies among them. We had an idea who was the CIA person. Certainly, a little later, I got selected to this. I got interviewed by Columbia, a group of professors. We were, a little later, in 1975, I looked at my CIA and FBI files under the Freedom of Information Act. And of course, the CIA and the FBI both checked up on me. But they didn't do so very well. In that file were interviews with Lipscomb and other people. Their names blacked out, but I could tell who was there. But they didn't find something which was in a public record, which, anyway, we were cleared for the, I think most suspicious was the fact that I was marrying a Swede at this point. This was bizarre. Anyway, the exchange was very valuable in the end because I just met in Russia one of the Soviet scientists, Oleg Nefedov, who went to Penn State to work with Phil Skell. Some of the leaders of Soviet science in subsequent years went through that exchange. Coming here was their first exposure to America. You can imagine the impact it had. And whenever I go to a Russian department somewhere, the people have been in Russia. In our year, there were two scientists on that exchange, Americans there, I and a remarkable fellow, Ulla Mathiesen, who was an expert on salmon, a matter of some interest to both the Russians and to us. He was a Norwegian-American who studied University of Washington. He had a great time. He got to travel, and we didn't get to travel at all. Anyway, I worked with Davidov, one of the people that was mentioned to me by Kasia. This was 1960-61. I could tell you lots about that year. This was the Khrushchev period. Began inauspiciously. It was the summer 1960 of the U-2 incident. American spy plane shot down by Russia. The world political situation influenced how we were treated. We were not treated well in the beginning. By the end, during the year, Kennedy got elected. Khrushchev thought Kennedy was a weakling. We got treated well because Kennedy got elected. It was bizarre. We had a wonderful year. There were no foreigners in Moscow except diplomats, a few journalists, no businessmen. It was a very special time. And I could tell you lots more about that. I didn't get that much science done, but I did something about an intensity of an electronic transition due to intermolecular transfer in a DNA molecule. I published in a Russian journal by myself, not with my advisor. The relationship with the advisor was very formal. I would see him once a week for an hour. That's it. There was no other. Our interaction with Russians in general was complicated. They were very interested. They were afraid. This was 7 years after Stalin. We did not get invited inside a Russian home during our whole year. We were invited into Uzbek and Georgian and Armenian homes because the tradition, because they were less afraid, those nationalities. But the great Russians, they were afraid.
What were the facilities like that you were in? Were they comparable to what you were in?
Living facilities were good. We lived in Moscow in that big wedding cake building of modern Moscow University. One of the waiting wings. I worked in a physics department. I had friends in chemistry. The facilities, this was the beginning of computers, so I went back to program the solution that I had come up with on a first IBM 604. They had no computers. They had no calculators. The laboratories, they were good in fields in which they had been good. I didn't know those fields. I learned those later. They were good in solid-state physics and in theory because it required no computation. And the Landau Kapitsa heritage was very strong. So they could do state-of-the-art work in solid-state theory. But in chemistry, there were a few areas when they were good. Sometimes those areas can be traced back to Tsarist times, even. This is a long story we can talk about. There was also, in theory, there was a controversy about theory of resonance in one of a number of ideological controversies raised by opportunists in Stalin's last days. Lauren Graham, who was a friend, who was on essay, who was a great historian of science, he was in the same exchange in the same year. He's written about us in a book about Moscow stories. Lauren has written about that resonance controversy. Lauren Graham has a chemical engineering background. He knows chemistry very well. He's retired, but you should get him back to talk about those.
Sure.
That controversy.
Didn't know about that. Yeah.
So he wrote his PhD thesis on that resonance theory controversy. And he was very important in cluing us in on, because he was an expert on Soviet science even then, when he was, he had just finished his PhD.
So you were together as a group of expats in a way? I mean,
yes, we lived in this building.
Okay.
All the Americans were put, there are about 13 floors in the dormitory wings. All the Americans were in the same rooms, 424, 524, 624. We figured out there was a cable running of listening devices down through those rooms.
Practical.
This is why we were put there. It was hilarious. Oh, we were treated very well by the American embassy and by the Swedish embassy too, and the Israeli embassy. I smuggled, I'm not religious, but I smuggled prayer books for the Israelis to the Jewish community, and CDs of music and all kinds of things like that. It was a different time, 1960. I'm very glad we did it. We never saw as much ballet and opera as we did in that year, because we could buy the tickets through a special ticket office for diplomats. And at the end, we had a wonderful trip to Central Asia and to the Caucasus, which is very vivid in our minds to this day. And we made many Russian friends. And after that, since I could give a lecture in Russian, I traveled very often to the Soviet Union. It remained an interest. And it was very important. I've traveled much less in post-Soviet times, because it's not so important now. But before then, you should imagine how an issue of Journal of Chemical Physics, how carefully it was read, how it was viewed. And Russian scientists are more interesting people than American scientists. And the reason is obvious. If you're a kid, age 19, and so you're entering the Soviet university system in 1960, you think you want to study philosophy, God forbid, or history. You're not stupid. You know that you're going to have to follow the party line.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, you will have trouble being in contact with the world outside. Whereas if you're a scientist, you're pretty immune from the party line. And you read the same journals, except you read them more carefully, because they're so precious to you. But so you had a lot of kids who in our world would have gone into history of art or philosophy, but there became physicists or chemists. And they were interesting people. They had interest in art. I made a number of friends, and I have them to this day. I'm trying to get some art exhibitions for one of them. But I don't have too much contacts. Let's see, we're going to stop at some point soon, but let's go on for a little while.
Sure. I think
go ahead.
A good stopping point would be when you start at Cornell. So I think
yes,
only
so let's go on. There is a few years to go.
Sure.
Still. So I'm at Harvard, I'm in a program in chemical physics. I take courses mainly in the physics department, some in the chemistry department. I'm working with Martin Guterman. Then Lipscomb comes to Harvard, hired as a crystallographer, but he also has theoretical interests. I switched to work with Lipscomb. It was already determined I would switch before I leave to Russia. So the timeline is, I'm there 2 years. At the end of the 2 years, I'm going to Russia. And I decided to switch to Lipscomb. But Lipscomb arrives during the year I'm in Russia. And I joined the Lipscomb group on my return. And I begin theoretical work on boron hydrides. And in the Lipscomb group at this point are five or six other theoreticians plus experimentalists. And we program in that year, 61 to 62. I come back from Russia, that's 60, 61. We program a variant of this extended Hickel method. And I've told the story of the origins of that in something that's published in Eugene Garfield's old Current Contents, where he had essays. And I wrote two essays on that. That method is the one is very important because that allows me then to do the organic molecules with Woodward later on. But I program it for boron hydrides. I publish in a tremendously productive year, 61 to 62. I get my PhD at the end, 4 years, even though one of them I was away. And I had enough papers, but I publish a series of papers. I publish my first papers in Journal of Chemical Physics, about four papers. In 1961, the papers don't get published till 63. Now 63 is the first extended, 62 is the first ones with Lipscomb. The reason I mention that is in 2012, I published a series of four papers in Journal of Chemical Physics, and I realized that my first publication, Journal of Chemical Physics, was two back-to-back papers, and then 50 years later, I published four. And that was a good feeling that I could publish those papers over a period of 50 years. The whole Journal of Chemical Physics is going only 75 years, so I was spanning a good part of that. I have a tremendous time. There's a lot of help. There is, there's a lot of collaboration among the graduate students. There are one postdoc and three graduate students, aside from myself. They all go on to careers, working with Lipscomb, and we program this extended Hickel type method for the boron hydrides, first of all.
Who did teach you the programming?
I learned Fortran. The language is still around today. I learned it from myself. I don't remember a book.
So another language you decided to?
Another language. It was easy. We had to punch cards so that we did for a few years to come. So all of us who grew up in that time have the sound of a key punch in our heads because we did it so much. And the program had to be recompiled each time, so there was this box of cards which was the program. The input data was just a few cards. But the box of cards had to be carried over to the computer or some other building. And if you dropped it, that was disaster. Because the order of the cards mattered.
Yes.
Was the program.
Was it relatively open access to the computer at that time? Or
yes,
were you
yes. These were... the beginning, there was a computer center. Very quickly, there was, within about 2 years during my junior fellowship, there was a computer center in the chemistry department. The Lipscomb group was very computer savvy because they were doing crystallography, and crystallography depends on computers, the growth of crystals. So programming and crystallography was already a going concern in the rest of the Lipscomb group. That Lipscomb became a theoretician, he placed an increasing amount of emphasis on this, and this was before he did another transition to becoming a a protein crystallographer and a biochemist, that he became a theorist graded on the powers that be in physical chemistry at Harvard. And I was at the focus of one event out there. So it was traditional for a graduate student at the time they got their PhD to give a physical chemistry seminar. So I did that in 1962 in the summer. And that was attended by the faculty, who usually were critical. But at this seminar, I was Lipscomb's first student at Harvard. I was Gutermann's first PhD student at Harvard. When I gave this seminar, it was about the boron hydride calculations. Bright Wilson got up afterwards and gave a scathing critique of the seminar, of what I was doing. So a little bit of background. Wilson, of course, knew quantum mechanics. There's a wonderful, influential book by Pauling and Wilson in the field. Wilson became more and more of an experimentalist. He also was a theorist on the part of molecular vibrations. So there's another great textbook, Wilson, Decius, and Cross, Molecular Vibrations. I see it on my shelf there, still useful. As far as theory, he took a wrong turn, and he became convinced that the way to do calculations was to solve Schrödinger's equation with various approximations, but to try to get lower and upper bounds on the energy. And he was the powers that be, which I referred to, means Wilson and Kistakovsky at that time.
George Kistakovsky,
a great physical chemist, just back, not too long before then, from being the head of the explosives division at Los Alamos, played a crucial part, a little bit lost in the romance with the physics of building the atom bomb. He knew about explosions and that an implosion was necessary there. Kistakovsky, I remember translating a speech he was going to give in Russia into Russian from English, because he came from a Russian family, but I knew Russian by this point better than he did. This is why I was involved in that. Wilson essentially disliked the kind of theory that Lipscomb did, and they didn't hire Lipscomb as a theorist. They hired Lipscomb as a crystallographer and a boron hydride chemist, and he did experimental work in the group too. Lipscomb also had the characteristic of wanting to say something about anything, and he was a very outspoken, and I don't know what happened next. I was, Wilson said, these are approximate calculations, they can't be right, essentially. Next thing that happened, before I got a chance to answer, Lipscomb bobs up, and the two of them proceed to have a big public debate about the nature of theory. And I just kept quiet. I said something too. But it was clear to me and to everyone in the room that this was not really about my seminar. It was really about Lipscomb and Wilson. Interesting. So in that year, to draw the timeline, it's now 62. I'm 25 years old. I have caught up in the sense that I finished college in 3 years. And I got my PhD in 4. I was really smart then. I could do things. Lying right over there are some of my notebooks from the college days, and there are some problem sets. There are problem sets that I solved and that I couldn't possibly do now, or that I really drank the stuff in, and it was the right combination. Anyway, I applied for jobs. This was now Sputnik days, post-Sputnik days, right, of 62. American universities were increasing the number of positions. There were lots of jobs. As a computer-trained theoretician, I was a reasonable commodity. I didn't even think of doing a postdoc. Today you would do a postdoc, but in those days, didn't. I applied for jobs. I got into my head. I applied to Yale, where I got rejected. Another time. I got in my head to go out west, and the only places in the east I applied were Yale and Cornell.
So jobs means academic jobs.
Assistant professorships.
Yeah.
At age 25, with a Harvard PhD. I got in my head to go out west, so I applied to University of Washington, Berkeley, Stanford, Caltech, and University of California in San Diego, which was new there. You can see the west coast sweeping down. Yeah. I got a job offer from each of them, except for Yale. Obviously, Lipscomb must have written a good letter. And the same time, I applied for a junior fellowship. And I think the advice to do so may have come from Dudley Hirschbach, who was a junior fellow, had just come. Junior fellowship was, there's a story, it's modeled on an English fellowship of a college. It was instituted in the 30s. It was thought as a way to bypass the PhD. It never worked that way. It was also used by Harvard to look over good people that it might hire. A number of extremely good people, Harvard faculty members, were junior fellows, among them Woodward and Hirschbach, and a number of other people who you've heard of, like McNamara and others, many good people. It was rather well paying. It paid the equivalent of an assistant professorship, about $11,000 at that time, was a reasonable salary. I applied for that and was accepted. It gave you 3 years to do some research without any responsibilities, without being tied. It was like a super postdoc, and you weren't connected to anyone. So I applied for that, and I don't exactly know why I took that over the jobs. Let me jump a little bit. 3 years later, 1965, I applied to all of the same places that I just mentioned, except Yale. I had given up on Yale. And I got a job from none of them, except Cornell. Mm. So what was the difference? And the difference was that was when I applied for those jobs, was November, December 64. The orbital symmetry work, the first paper was in, the first of five communications that were published in 65 was in. I had spoken about the work at two meetings. The first paper doesn't get published till January 65 yet. And the organic chemists around the country knew something, that this work was coming, even though the work was not published. A few knew about it. But the decisions were made around January 65, and I will caricature it, but in 1962, I was a promising theoretical chemist with great achievements in a very short period on sort of the state-of-the-art calculations of the electronic structure of molecules. That was the work I did with Lipscomb. And I had clearly an orientation toward computers, which were a very was a very saleable positive item. 1965, I was tainted by organic chemistry. I was all the same things before, but I had gotten interested in organic molecules. And an organic colleague at Berkeley, like Hip Dauben, going to his physical chemist, I was being hired by the physical, I was still physical, and telling him, hey, I've heard of this great work by Roald Hoffman and Woodward about the stereochemistry of these reactions. That was not a positive thing, necessarily. It was organic stuff. So another year later, it would have been totally different. But Cornell is the only ones who held the faith, and that's why I'm here.
So, I mean, why was organic chemistry tainting at this point?
No, it was that I had gone from pure theory toward applied, toward molecule. It was...
So was it that, I mean, from your perspective, was it just that people didn't know what you were committed to, and so there was hesitancy about where you were going? Or was there something about the science specific, the area that you were choosing?
I think the area was, I was becoming more applied somehow. I wasn't. And also, I think what was happening was I had developed this method, the extended Hickel theory, which was a semi-empirical molecular orbital method. It involved some parameters. And I was... Meanwhile, the theory field had taken off toward what were subsequently called ab initio calculations. And they were also begun in the Lipscomb group and elsewhere. And by 65, those ab initio calculations had a greater cachet than my semi-empirical calculations. And those people who made the evaluations no longer thought I was state-of-the-art progressive.
Okay.
I think that's a little bit of... You could talk to some organic chemist about how this felt in that period.
So you were between two stools in a way.
I was.
And so, I mean, I've read quite a bit about... clashes between ab initio and semi-empirical methods. Did this dichotomy, or whatever you would call it, continue in your career? And where would you place yourself in this?
Oh, now I'm, well, we'll talk about that tomorrow.
Okay.
There's something worth talking about. So this is now interesting about disciplines and what's fashionable, what's important, and how community. Let me quickly sketch the 3 years of the junior fellowship,
sure.
The next stage of my development, because the end of, but I just wanted to tell you the story,
mm-hmm.
because it explains very simply why I'm at Cornell. It's the only place that offered me a job, 65.
The lucky ones, huh?
Yeah.
A year later, I had job offers from everywhere. But I started the junior fellowship. So as a junior fellow, I was independent of Lipscomb, with whom I had done my PhD, but he was at the same place. I did not know Woodward. I had met Woodward twice. No, once at that point. That was... because he interviewed all the incoming graduate students as part of a committee. He was a mythical figure at that time. There has been much written about Woodward, including a very good book that Ted Benfey did for the CHF. Though that book was just before the Corey claim, which is an interesting addendum. And Jeff Seaman is doing a major study of the Corey claim and Woodward. There'll be more. I didn't know any of the organic chemists. I was an independent theoretician. I had a reasonable salary. I could apply for research grants, and I think I got my first NSF grant. These junior fellows could apply for grants, which was unusual. I was by myself, and I decided to work on organic molecules. This is without talking to any of the organic chemists. I don't know exactly why, but I saw that the methodology could be applied. Oh, I guess the first organic problem that I encountered was during the Lipscomb days, because next to me was Russ Pitzer. This is the son of Kenneth Pitzer, a very important American theoretical chemist. And he was calculating the first, he was doing the first ab initio calculation of the barrier to internal rotation in ethane. I think that was my first introduction to a problem. And, but he was doing it with ab initio methods. So I thought I would do that with this extended Hickel method, which we developed in the Lipscomb group. Anyway, I developed that method a little more. And I applied it to some simple shapes and geometries of organic molecules. And that's the series of two or three papers in Journal Chemical Physics in 1963 called Extended Hickel 1, 2, 3. When I wrote those papers, that was sort of toward the end of my first year as a junior fellow, I made an appointment with the leading organic chemist in the department to show them the paper, to tell them what I could do, and to ask them if there were any interesting problems to which this theory could be applied. So I went to see Frank Westheimer. I went to see Woodward, Paul Bartlett. Maybe I went to see Conrad Bloch. E.J. Corey had not come yet. Came in my second year, or maybe in the first year already. Anyway, that was the second time I met Woodward. He gave me an hour of his time. He listened very carefully, and he asked some good questions, but he had no suggestions at that point of anything to work on. Neither did any of the others. Meanwhile, Corey had come. Maybe I talked to Corey. And Corey had an office down the hall. And we are now in 19... The first year of my junior fellowship was 62 to 63. We're now in the second year, 63 to 64. I'm sure Corey came the year before, but somehow I got to talk to Corey. He had an office down the hall from me in the basement of this old building. And he was very approachable. He was younger. So our ages are now by a factor, are decade apart. I am 10 years younger than Corey and 20 years younger than Woodward. Woodward was born 1917, Corey 27, I'm 37. Corey was a full professors, attracted from Illinois, and he told me about some problems he was working on, and I tried some calculations stimulated by these. There are no papers jointly with Corey with me, but I thank Corey in several of my papers at that time. Also, one of in the spring of 64, one of Corey's buddies from Illinois, Doug Applequist, an organic chemist, comes to give on a sabbatical and gives a, or a visiting professor, gives a course of lectures about modern physical organic chemistry. I had tried before in my first year to sit in on a course by Paul Bartlett, who was the leading physical organic chemist of his time, perhaps along with Dering and Winstein. These three people shaped American physical organic chemistry. Winstein, Dering, and Bartlett. Bartlett was a dry, American Yankee type New England. Yeah, it was not easy to communicate with him in some way. I tried to sit in by a course by Bartlett. I have a few notes from one of those, but I don't have, but it wasn't too exciting overall. But the course that Applequist taught in the spring of 64, this is the end of the second year, the second part of my 3-year fellowship, that was all about reactions, what we would now call 2+2 cycloadditions proceeding through di radicals. He talks about cyclopropane, all these exciting things. I started doing calculations on cyclopropanes. He talked about non-classical carbonium ions, which I'd also heard from Corey. I start some calculations, and there's a paper on non-classical carbonium ions. Somehow, these people, Applequist and Corey, found a way to get me. They told me about modern organic chemistry. The subjects were non-classical carbonium ions, organic photochemistry, strained rings, aromaticity I knew about from my senior seminar at Columbia, still in Breslau, but things had advanced. Somehow these were the hottest topics of physical organic chemistry, and I got excited about them. And I was doing these calculations. I was still very much a computational chemist. So when on one day in May 1964, my third encounter with Woodward, I told you the first two, one was as a graduate and the other was I didn't talk to him, but I didn't sense any communication. Woodward came down with Applequist to my little office, and they told me, and Woodward told me about, essentially, about the electrocyclic reaction. I have it in my notes. I used to keep notebooks then, thank God. These old notebooks, which are these Wurm and Peace wonderful notebooks that we get found. This.
Is this the one of the year? That's
no,
later.
It's another one. But this is what they look like.
Okay.
I pasted in things. It's these are, and Jeff Seaman has been through these. I didn't date them. I was not an industrial chemist.
No patents.
And that not dating is a terrible problem in taking apart the Woodward Corey claim. Here and there, there's a date.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see how it's pencil, it's pen, these are wonderful documents. The ones that are specifically the one on the period of the Corey claim is deposited at Cornell in the collection. I have a copy of it. These are later, but what you can see in these notebooks, and you can see it even here, it's a little later, it's a year later, but you see here numbers. This is where I was in 63, 64. So there are rows of numbers. I'm doing calculations. There are graphs. But I'm beginning to sketch molecules. As this goes on, the molecules get more complex. And I'm beginning to draw orbitals. And the numbers are suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of what I told you about the struggle with a computer.
There's one there.
Yes, Jack.
Here, Woodward.
Yeah.
We are during
February 25th and via Dürr. Yeah.
So you were in touch with William von Eggers during as well?
He came to give
time.
A talk. He wasn't at Harvard then.
I see.
This is, we can date these because of some papers I read that have dates on them. So this is, here is a date, my God. So this is later. I'm now at Cornell.
66, yeah.
Yeah. But these are wonderful documents. No one made me keep good notebooks. I wish I would have dated them, but I did keep them at least. Anyway, Woodward comes and asks me a question about these reactions and gives me the simple frontier orbital argument, which Corey claims that he told to Woodward. We'll come back to the Corey claim inevitably. But what I do when Woodward tells me both the problem abstracted out of the, in part, vitamin D context, I would never have looked at the literature of vitamin D photochemistry. It's too complicated for me at that stage of life. But he's familiar with it. He knows Havinga. He's talking to them. But there were also physical organic chemists like Vogel and Krieger, two of the, along with Hiskin, those are the three greatest physical organic chemists of the time in Germany. Vogel and Krieger are doing experiments, and Woodward, those I could have understood, but I still didn't read the literature yet. He brings me those experiments, and he gives me the first simple orbital explanation. And my reaction to that is, let me do some calculations. That is, I don't really appreciate Woodward's explanation.
Have you heard before of frontier orbital theory?
Not as such, but I knew Foucault's work a little bit. I learn it more. What Woodward gives me is a frontier orbital argument, but we didn't call it at that time that.
Sure.
So that's an anachronism in the context, even though the word is in the literature before, but it was not used by either Woodward or
what
me.
What did he use?
He just said orbital.
Just said orbital.
So now we have another. Now you need to talk to Jeff Seaman, because who's researched this in some detail. And who knew what when. I go away and do calculations. That is, I put into the computer the coordinates of a butadiene, and I start rotating the outside CH2s in the two different ways that Woodward told me that they might go. And I do this, we can trace it in a notebook. I do this with no sense that this is an important problem. You can see that in the notebooks, because it's interspersed with days and days of stuff on other boring things that are of more interest to me. I come back to it, maybe Woodward asks me, I don't know. I come back to it, and the first time I get it wrong, I don't get a preference for the conrotatory butadiene to cyclobutene closing. They come out about the same. I don't get the wrong answer. But then I realize that what I'm doing is that the reaction coordinate during this butadiene going to cyclobutene, not only do the ends rotate, initially I'm stupid, I just rotate the ends and I don't do anything else. I realize that I must decrease the CCC angle to go from 120 degrees or so in butadiene to more or less 90 degrees in the cyclobutene. And when I do that, it comes out the way it should. That doesn't happen for 3 or 4 months after he tells me that story.
Was Woodward very impatient?
No.
No.
That was, I never remember Woodward impatient about anything.
Okay.
That was, but he, though he was sometimes insistent, but not. No, but I think he talked to me. Anyway, it's, even at this point, when I do the calculation, I go back, and we have the evidence, and Jeff has assembled it. From Woodward decides to write a paper. We write this paper in October. We submit it in November. This is all 64. Gets published in January. Well, we submit it December. What we have is various drafts of that first paper. Woodward asked me to write a paper, a draft of the theoretical part, and I do. And it's all calculations. There's nothing about the orbital argument. That's all Woodward's. But slowly with time, and especially on the next paper on cycloadditions, I begin to appreciate the value of the what we would now call the frontier orbital argument. And at that point, that notebook is very interesting to look at. And I think Jeff has made me appreciate what went on then much more by looking at it in such detail and asking questions. But what's happening is I don't appreciate the simple argument or simple arguments in general. I'm just a calculator to begin with. But at the same time, I'm drinking in organic chemistry. And I'm learning on my own perturbation theory, which is the natural language behind frontier orbital arguments. And I learn that, and I sort of independently discover frontier orbital arguments without being that much aware. Even though I was aware of Fukui's work, I didn't connect it to that. And I don't know Dewar's use of perturbation theory. And there's another whole story about why Dewar is so unhappy with us. But anyway, it's a wonderful story because I'm learning a new field of chemistry, and I'm changing from being a calculator to being an explainer. And that was the fundamental transformation that the orbital symmetry story meant for me. But I think the seeds were already there in Lipscomb's way. But so now we're going to stop because
yes.
I have to call my wife.
Yeah, it's 6 o'clock.
And 6 o'clock. But let me just finish very briefly. So I stay 1 year more, 65, 64. I look for jobs. The orbital symmetry papers begin to be published. The first two are published when I'm still at Harvard. The last two at the end of the year, 65, I'm already at Cornell. They get published here. Woodward and I go on working for 4 years on a long paper. And a lot of interesting things happen. But 1965, a lot of things happen along the way. 63, in the second year, our first child is born, a son. A lot of the orbital symmetry work, the second paper I'm doing while I'm babysitting for my son. I remember it clearly. My wife was out teaching Swedish, I think. Anyway, 65, we come here. Our daughter was 3 weeks old. I look at her and I can see how long we've been here, 50 years. And then there's more to tell about Cornell and science, but let's stop now.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
I'm getting hoarse, but I